founder of Pretty Deadly Self-Defense, a self-defense program for women I developed based on my experience as a violent crime survivor and my 24 years of training in the Japanese art of ninjutsu. I'm going to dive right in and in this episode talk about some of the scary stories and myths that are often But before I go on, I just want to give a shout out to our latest batch of certified trainers. Heading out into new territory in their coaching, fitness, and martial arts businesses, armed with a fresh set of soft leadership skills, trauma awareness and support tools, and the full support and all the love of everyone on the Pretty Deadly team. We love seeing coaches invest in their communities through responsible self-defense. And if you're interested in leveling up your teaching and leadership skills, or you're just looking for a social impact side hustle, check out our upcoming certification schedules in the US, the UK, and Europe at prettydeadlypro.com. Now, back to our episode, scary stories and myths. Again, trigger warning, I am going to be speaking about some fairly graphic incidents that have happened to people. In our last episode, I spoke in greater detail about a few of the moments in the attack that I survived. I talked about a few moments in the incident that I survived that were also very graphic and violent and scary. When I am teaching self-defense or giving self-defense workshops, I usually let everybody in the room know that they're free to ask me any question at any time, but that I always reserve the right to not answer something if I'm not comfortable answering it. One of the things that I don't like to focus on is the attack that I survived. And the reason why is because I don't want to use fear or scary stories as a motivator to learn self-defense. Why don't I want to use that? I mean, fear is a cheap tool to sell things. You know, look at the gun industry in America. But the reason that I don't like to use it, fear as a motivator, fear as a tool to sell self-defense classes or keep people training in a self-defense class, well, for two reasons. One, it perpetuates the association of negativity with learning how to trust our bodies. We can learn how to trust our bodies in very positive ways by learning gymnastics or going to the gym or acrobatics or yoga or dance or whatever. But to learn to trust our bodies in a defensive way, to learn to trust the defense mechanisms in our body is always associated with fear. And I believe that's one of the reasons that people are reluctant to learn self-defense. One of my biggest missions behind Pretty Deadly is to turn learning self-defense into a form of body positivity. I want people to have a positive association with the things that they're learning. The second reason that I don't like to use fear as a motivator, especially once a course or a class has already started, is because, especially for women and marginalized groups, we know we don't need to hear scary stories. We live those scary stories. We don't need to be reminded of how dangerous it is out there. That's why we're in the class in the first place. So it can be very salacious to use these stories. And remember that true crime podcasts are wildly popular with women specifically. And one of the reasons why is because women are listening to those and actually learning how to defend ourselves in those situations. However, that doesn't prevent people from using scary stories in self-defense anyway. And I'm going to share some of the ones that were used in some of the self-defense classes that I've taken over the years before I created Pretty Deadly. One of the most popular stories, of course, is the New York story. A woman is raped in broad daylight and murdered. Sometimes only raped, sometimes stabbed to death, sometimes raped and murdered. Choose your poison, I guess. A crowd of people are watching, not a single person intervenes to help, and she's killed. What this story tells us, and the way that it's used in self-defense classes is specifically for this, is to try and illustrate to the people in the class, no one's going to help you. No one's coming to save you. You have to know how to save yourself. People will stand around and just watch you die. This is terrible. And while there's a lot of things happening in the world right now that would sort of support that argument on a geopolitical level, to tell people this in a self-defense class is kind of shooting yourself in the foot as a self-defense trainer. It shuts people down. It makes people feel like, you know what, then why, if nobody's going to help me and I'm not sure I can help myself, if you're going to tell me on top of this that I have to train forever, that so that my muscles gain the muscle memory, if I'm going to have to strength train to get extra strength in case I go up against somebody bigger and stronger than me. Again, it's hopelessness, hopelessness, hopelessness on top of people will literally stand around and watch you die. It's a really scary story, and it touches on some of the deepest fears that women especially have, in that no one's going to help us. No one's going to save us. This is a form of, well, this is a cause for cognitive dissonance, especially among white women. I have not had this conversation with women of color, people in the LGBTQ community, and I'm happy to have that conversation at any time if anyone would like to volunteer. So my point is I can't really speak on behalf of people with who identify in those ways, but I am also a white woman, and I know the kind of social cues that we were given, or, you know, the social cues that guided us as we were raised as white women in the world. And one of those really subtle stories is someone will come and save you. Whether you go to what now feels like an old-fashioned trope, the knight in shining armor, the knight on a white horse savior, to any one of the Disney princesses over the last 20 years or so, to even more recently, this idea of standing up for yourself, but really someone's gonna come in and help you and save you. And again, I get the logic behind it. To tell this really scary story of no one's going to save you, no one's going to help you, you have to do it yourself, is this idea of like we have to drill this into people's heads. But you're drilling it into people's heads with such a negative story, with something that's so scary that they're going to reject it. No one wants to remember that. And then they're not going to want to remember the things that are associated with learning. Or why they're learning self-defense in the first place. And the second story that I was told in one of the self-defense courses that I took was this. A woman's car broke down on the side of the road. Someone stopped to help her. She got in the car with them. They attempted to rape her, or maybe they did rape her, and they cut off her arms and threw her down a ditch and drove off. So that's really horrifying. And actually, the very first time I heard that story, I was like, that cannot even be true. That sounds completely ridiculous to me. The reasoning behind the story was, again, to illustrate, this is how dangerous it is for you out there as women. This is how vulnerable you are. This is what kind of sickos are driving around just looking to harm women. But again, it was such an extreme story that it felt absurd. It made me lose respect a little bit for the person telling the story, who was the self-defense instructor at the time, and made me kind of not believe some of the things they were teaching us because I didn't believe this story. So I feel like that had a bit of a backwards effect. There's a story that came out recently, actually, in an area where a pretty deadly certified self-defense trainer lives. This is a true story of a little girl who was playing in her front yard and was approached by a stranger who almost snatched her out of the front yard and kidnapped her. Her brother, who happened to be in the house at the time, looked out the window and saw that a struggle was going on, and actually, in one of the greatest like little rascals moments ever, used his slingshot and shot the guy with some pebbles in his face and chest, which made him let go of the little girl, and she ran off and was safe. So in this story, I don't know of anyone who's used the story as part of their teaching methodology, but I'm bringing it up simply because it was brought to my attention by a pretty deadly certified trainer. In fact, one of our master trainers And she had something really interesting to say about it in the way that it was reported in the local news and in her interpretation. So I'm going to ask you to put a pin in that, and I'm going to come back and revisit it. And the last story that I'm going to mention in this, again, not a teaching story, or not a story that I think anyone is using at the moment in teaching, but this is also a Pretty Deadly certified trainer. I included her story a couple of episodes ago. I think it's episode 119, if you want to go back and listen to it. She was assaulted on the street in Spain while on holiday. Again, somebody just came up and grabbed her. And she told the story. She made a video recording immediately after it happened. And she was breathing hard and obviously highly agitated and scared and reacting to that. And again, it's a story that I've seen in forms in self-defense courses of, you know, somebody's going to come up and grab you. Somebody's going to do this. Somebody's going to do that. And of course, that's terrifying for us as women and marginalized people, that someone will assault us from any direction at any time, and we're completely vulnerable. But again, using these as teaching tools in this way of kind of building it up of like, somebody's going to come and get you out of nowhere, is putting your clients on the defensive before they're learning any self-defense. And if they're already on the defensive because of your story, they're going to be defensive about learning anything from you, even if they want to. Now they've got two sides of themselves fighting, basically, in the sense of, I need to learn these things to protect me, but I don't want to think about these things that I have to learn to protect me, because I don't want to think about the story. There's another side to all of these stories that I wish were spoken about more. Our New York story. That story has been floating around since the 1960s. It is one of the original urban myths, I would say, at least late 20th century urban myths. Something very like this happened in the story originated from the actual case. The case is called the Kitty Genovese case. This woman was, in fact, stabbed to death. But the story is not as simple as that, actually. She was assaulted by her apartment building. She was screaming for help. Neighbors did respond. They did call the police, and then the screaming stopped. The person ran off. The person that was assaulting her ran off, and she thought she was safe. She went into a parking garage. She was followed where the man was lying in wait for her. And for lack of a better term, finished the job. That's where he actually killed her. When she was killed, she was out of sight and out of earshot. But when she was first assaulted, the neighbors actually responded. People did actually try to intervene and call for help. It's a shame, and it will always be a shame, a tragedy. A shame isn't a strong enough word. It will always be a tragedy that Kitty Genovese was murdered in this very brutal way. But to use her death as an illustration of uncaring humanity is disrespectful to her and is unfair to all the people that actually did intervene. This story was told in this way and blown up this way because it was more, again, it was more salacious. It sold more papers to tell the story in the way that the neighbors didn't respond. This story came up again recently in an attack in Philadelphia where a woman was raped on a subway train for 6 minutes and nobody intervened, is the way that the press started talking about the story. But the police chief of Philadelphia actually brought up the Kitty Genovese case, and he said, this is a very dangerous thing to say, because that's not true. While that rape was taking place, that train was going from stop to stop. People were getting on and getting off. So for everyone who might have witnessed something that they weren't even sure what was going on, they saw maybe a fraction of a second of it, or maybe a minute. Right? The police were called. It took the police 6 minutes to arrive, which is actually shorter than the shortest ever recorded response time, which is 7 minutes. So it took the police 6 minutes to get to the station, wherever the train was pulling in, to arrive and intervene. To use the story of all these people were on the train and watching this happen and nobody did a thing is not true, and it's inaccurate. And yeah, it'll sell the story. It's much more interesting to hear about, you know, the cold-heartedness of humanity than it is to hear about the reality of, you know, people were witnessing something that they didn't understand what they were seeing, and they were only seeing small portions of it. This does not excuse anybody or anything, but I think putting it in context is very important. The story that I heard of the woman who was picked up and her arms were cut off and she was thrown down, I'm sorry, not a ditch, she was thrown down a ravine, is a true story, it turns out, because I looked it up, because it was so absurd to me. It seemed so extreme that I couldn't believe that this had actually happened, but it did. The woman is named Mary McGriff. She, I think, was around 14 years old at the time. It happened in 1978. She wasn't driving because she was 14. She was hitchhiking because it was the 70s and people hitchhiked. She was picked up by somebody who, I'd have to look up the case again. I can no longer remember if she was actually raped as well, but they did cut off her arms and threw her down a ravine. That, again, that's a horrifying story. But what's never spoken about is the fact that she survived. This 14-year-old girl, and this I have looked up, she was never in the Girl Scouts. I don't know if she learns any kind of survival training from her parents, but from what I could read, nothing. Somehow, she figured out how to staunch the blood flow from her arms and dragged herself up the side of this ravine back onto the highway to flag down the next car that came along. Of course, she's completely covered in blood at this point, and the car that came along saved her, drove her to the hospital and saved her. She runs marathons. She is an artist. She, of course, is an advocate for survivors of violence. Mary McGriff is a hero, and we don't hear that part of the story. We don't hear the part of the story where she saved herself. That is so important for people when they're learning self-defense, to know that you can save yourself and hear the examples. If you have to use scary stories, please use them in this way. The little girl who was almost kidnapped out of her front yard. The reason that this was brought to my attention by our master trainer, Christy Johnson in Michigan, is because this happened in her hometown, or where she lives now, at least. But also because Christy was kind of appalled by the fact that all of these accolades were being given to the brother who shot his slingshot, even though he deserved praise, absolutely, for intervening. But none of the praise was being given to the girl who struggled against the man and broke free and ran. She also saved herself. And it's really, really important for little girls, as well as for adult women, as well as for every single person, men, women, everyone on the gender spectrum, regardless of ethnic background, religious background, skin color, etc., all of these things, to understand that people do actually save themselves. In our trainer Natalie's story, if you listen to the entire story, Natalie goes on to talk about, thanks to her self-defense training, both as an instructor, as well as someone who took the course as a student or as a client, thanks to her self-defense training, she was able to respond in a very decisive way to the man that grabbed her, that helped her get away and make some space. And she saved herself. Things that are so important to focus on, because why are we teaching people self-defense? We're teaching people self-defense to give them confidence, to empower them, to level the playing field a little bit. We live in a violent world. We live in a world that's also beautiful and joyful and full of love and caring, but there's also violence. There's also people who just like to do violent things to other people for no real reason other than they're violent. And there's people who like to focus on parts of our population that they know generally don't know how to defend ourselves, which tends to be women and tends to be marginalized people. So why are we teaching self-defense? It's to empower people. Why are we committed to doing this? To help our clients, to help people in the world, to help our communities feel confident and strong and know that they can go on to change the world. You're not going to change the world from a place of fear. You're not going to be motivated in a sustainable way from scary stories. You're going to be motivated in a much more sustainable and powerful way when we see examples of people who can do it anyway, who survive and who thrive. You have been listening to the Pretty Deadly Podcast. You can learn more about who we are and what we do, and how to find a Pretty Deadly course near you by visiting our website at prettydeadlyselfdefense.com. And if you're a fitness or martial arts pro and you'd like to enhance your instructor skills, our certification programs are open for enrollment, and you can find them on our website at prettydeadlypro.com. This podcast is produced by Singe Network for Pretty Deadly, recorded in Berlin, and our original music is The Track by Dylan and Betsy.